The sounds of those seeking sanctuary vary. Some sounds are loud, like the Hunchback of Notre Dame as he swings down from that Gothic church in Paris, when Charles Laughton, in the title role, sees Maureen O'Hara as Esmeralda, about to be hung for being a witch. He swings over from the church balcony and rescues her from the executioner and takes her back to the church, yelling, "Sanctuary! Sanctuary! Sanctuary!" And the crowd goes wild. The sounds of sanctuary can also be very quiet, almost like whispers heard as stocking feet ascend a wooden staircase. Anne Frank and her family lived in such a place. And in 1989, when I was traveling to Kenya, I stopped to see this famous house of sanctuary in Amsterdam. And in taking that infamous tour, I walked behind the bookcase and up those narrow steps, almost feeling the eyes of a potential Nazi soldier behind me. While in those tiny rooms, I imagined the silence that would be required for me to live in this sanctuary. I remember my great-grandfather talking about how his uncle had emancipated himself one night from the brutality of enslavement. Somehow he just managed to slip off into the night to hide in a swamp, breathing through a reed of straw, sucking oxygen bubbles as he sought sanctuary in anaerobic bacteria. Things have got to be really, really bad for someone or some family to decide to leave where they are and seek sanctuary somewhere else. To leave their homes to find refuge in another place takes an imagination far beyond what I could ever come up with. Having to pull up every root, everything you've ever known, every object, every friend, every place that has defined your identity and leave it all behind. How could you do that? How? I believe because people seeking sanctuary believe that they themselves are worthwhile and deserve something better. Something better than the horror that is facing them. Something better than the horror that's chasing them. It could be crop failure, perpetual unemployment, gangs, untreatable diseases, state violence, or the poor preying upon the poor. But whatever the reason, the need to protect oneself and one's loved ones is probably the greatest example of human self-affirmation we can ever, ever witness. An even greater human assertion is that belief that there could be something better and that you had the agency to do it. The Franks in Amsterdam knew that there had to be something better than watching the scientific and systemic extermination of the Jews. My great-grandfather, his uncle, knew that there was something better as he was sucking air from a reed in a swamp, something better than being treated like a hated dog every day. Those migrants walking from Central America know that there must be something better, a place for their children to be safe from the continued unrelenting and purposeful destabilization of their countries. You see, there's something special about those seeking sanctuary because everybody doesn't leave. This group walking to freedom is a tiny fraction of the people in Central America. There are over 20 million people in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala. But everybody didn't leave the plantations either. Some Jews thought that the Nazi phase would pass and that things would get back to normal, so they stayed put. But what is it about these people? What makes them seek sanctuary? I believe that they are set apart by two things. First, they are set apart because they are self-motivated by their own moral imagination. They believe that their inherent worth and dignity is non-negotiable. Non-negotiable. Their lives and the lives of their families that they care for are worth taking the needed risk. Moral imagination means to envision a full range of possibilities in a particular situation in order to solve an ethical dilemma. Think about it. The social structures have been designed to fail those seeking sanctuary. They failed the German Jews and the American Jews as well when they sought sanctuary here. They failed the enslaved Africans and then the free blacks. And they have failed the Compañeras of Central America and the DACA kids from Los Angeles. But they still imagine righteousness, equity, and fairness. Freedom has always been precarious for these people, but they still imagine it. It has always been precarious for black and brown people who stood on the legal margins of society. Blackness and enslavement were so firmly connected to antebellum Southern life that to be free and black was to be a civic anomaly. It takes moral imagination against all odds to survive perpetual systems of dehumanization. Sanctuary seekers also have self-empathy and the awareness to discern what is morally relevant in a given situation. The very act of seeking sanctuary is the spark that ignites the flame of this moral imagination, an imagination to envision new and creative alternatives. For instance, I can see myself as a free human being. I can see myself as safe. I can see myself worshiping my chosen faith. People seeking sanctuary also have the moral courage to see themselves as human beings and as persons, and not as objects whose value rests in utility and usefulness. In many ways, seeking sanctuary is a process by which an individual curates as well, metaphors from images that are recorded deep into the senses of the basic forms of humanity that we all share. Those senses of safety and sanctuary and dignity for oneself are stored in our memory, which are then surfaced when that person faces suffering and can bring forth a moral correspondence in lived experience. This requires them to have an intuitive belief that truth can be found in chaos, and there is hope for the proper ordering of the soul by finding sanctuary. And I also believe that in addition to moral imagination, these people seeking sanctuary are set apart by a sense of generativity, a term made famous by Erik Erikson in the 1950s to denote a concern for establishing and guiding the next generation. It describes a need to nurture and guide the next generation. People seeking sanctuary want to first have their children and their community survive. By providing them with a safe harbor, they seek to care and teach this next generation the stories, the history, the beliefs, the values, the accomplishments, the joys of their people. They want to show their children that their continued existence matters. One of the greatest moments of generativity for black people in America was the period called Reconstruction, right after slavery. The first thing that these quasi-free black people did was go and search for relatives. Go and find your auntie. Go and find your mother and father and your children that had been sold all over the place. They went looking for them, their partners, their loved ones. And as they sought their families, they banded together and made new families of chosen families along roadsides, in swamps, and in burnt-out plantations, seeking refuge as landless people with no rights. But very quickly, within 50 years, all over this country, these bands of illiterate, homeless, nomadic people built black towns throughout the South and the West as they sought sanctuary from the brutality of America. Following World War I and during the oil boom of the 1910s, the Greenwood section outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was one of those towns. Recognized nationally for its affluent African Americans, this thriving business district and surrounding residential area was referred to as Black Wall Street. In fact, the district was so successful that a dollar would stay within that community an estimated 19 months before it was spent elsewhere. Not only did Black Americans want to contribute to the success of their own shops, but there were also racial segregation laws that prevented them from shopping anywhere else other than Greenwood. They ran oil wells. They built civic organizations, churches, and political structures that demonstrated the generativity of a people without sanctioned universal franchise into the American system. Greenwood may have been a haven for African Americans, but the state of Oklahoma was not. They had strict laws limiting the rights of black people, schools, in schools, hospitals, public accommodation, stores, restaurants, you name it. And miscegenation was a felony, and segregation was the law. Lynchings were not uncommon, and by 1920, the Klan was reemerging in that state significantly. But despite all of this, they had the moral imagination to see themselves as worthy of dignity and worthy of prosperity and worthy of a life where they could thrive in their own sanctuary. And that sanctuary was one of generativity. Now, we have a lot of stories in this country's history that start with despite. And then there's also an until. So I say, despite all of that, until May 31st, 1921. On that day in Greenwood, 6-year-old Olivia Hooker was home with her family when a group of white men came through the backyard carrying torches. Her mother quickly hid her underneath a table and put a tablecloth underneath it, and all of her 3 siblings hiding in the dining room, silent, covered, hidden. Her mother said, "Don't make a sound." The men then entered the house and began to destroy everything that was of value first. They broke her father's record player and took an axe to her sister Irene's beloved piano before moving on to other homes and businesses in the community. The New York Times at the time wrote, "Fires had been started by hundreds of white invaders soon after 1 o'clock, and other fires were set from time to time. By 8 o'clock, practically the entire 30 blocks of homes in the Negro quarters were in flames, and few buildings escaped destruction. Negroes caught in their burning homes and businesses were, in many instances, shot down as they attempted to escape. Hundreds of black people murdered and 6,000 arrested for creating their own sanctuary town. No sanctuary for Greenwood or Rosewood in Florida or Bridgeton in New Jersey or the colored children's home that was burned to the ground in New York City in 1923. No sanctuary. But despite Olivia Hooker, that little 6-year-old girl hiding underneath that table, she went on to demonstrate the moral imagination and generativity found in those that live without sanctuary. In 1945, Olivia Hooker became the first African-American woman to join the U.S. Coast Guard. She went on to earn a doctorate degree in psychology and helped form the Tulsa Race Riot Commission in 1997 to investigate this massacre and make a case for reparations. Dr. Hooker is now 103 years old and thought to be the last surviving witness to the Tulsa Race Riot of 21. In Dr. Hooker's testimony, she talked about the joy of her home in Greenwood before the invasion. Like so many, she knew that being in a sanctuary offered means that you had to live in a constant state of vigilance, always looking both ways, always worried about being caught, always worried about being found out, always worried about being threatened or wiped out. The liminal nature of sanctuary space makes them very temporary. A sanctuary, but for how long? But for how long? Friends, I have to share with you something I do with an open heart, and I hope yours remains open as well. And you heard me previously, I said from this pulpit, I talk authentically about my joy and interest and belief in the idea of America and its unique historical constellations and the aspirations that we have as a country. Yet, I hold these democratic aspirations in complete and continued tension because we, the children of enslaved Africans, we, the foundational human engine that created this entire country and all American wealth, we, the people of a darker hue, we have no safe space. Friends, know that I have never experienced a feeling of sanctuary ever in my 61 years in this country. I believe the perilous and insidious day-to-day realities of being Black in America has altered a lot of Black people's brain chemistry. I come up with this crazy theory because this is the only way I can explain it. Maybe our brain chemistry has been altered and recalibrated to make us immune from the fanciful vision that we could ever live a life of sanctuary in America. As a result, I do not yearn for that impossible day when I can rest my head and rest my burdens down and rest my ancestors' burdens down. I do not hope for it because 400 years of fantasies place limitations on my sanity. Yet, there is a gift in all of this. Because of this lack of sanctuary, my moral imagination, my passionate generativity rises above and subverts the intents of those who would deny me sanctuary, that would deny me peace. Given the limited resources that Black folks have had to work with, given the odds, given the constant debasing of our very souls, look what we have done. Look what we have done. Our moral imagination is evident in jazz, in literature, in art, in philosophy, in religion, in politics, in science, in engineering. You name it, you'll find some quiet, unassuming Black person who made a way out of no way. Despite the obstacles we have and do face, we have excelled. Black lives matter despite sanctuary. We have learned to take jargon like the Negro problem, the book you probably read from the 60s, into a new place, calling it Black joy and Black girl magic. These are movements of generativity, of moral imagination. Look it up. Despite sanctuary, we know who we are. Despite sanctuary, we love ourselves. Think about this. If Black people are at the bottom of every single statistic indicator for health and education, life expectancy, all the disparities, first at the bottom, first at the top of the bottom, then Black women are at the very bottom of these everyday statistics that we read. Yet who has the lowest suicide rate in America? Black women.
Yup. Those with the highest suicide rate in America? White men. Yeah. Despite living in a society that never has and never will honor my blackness as sacred enough to hold me in complete, unconditional humanness, my worldview is shaped and informed and guided by the generativity of our great, unparalleled story of a people. We are an invented people. There was no such thing as an African-American before Italian navigation, Spanish greed, the King James Bible, and the disorganized thinking about humanity attributed to racism. I did not exist before. I am a creation of this story. Yet, you can't wipe us out. No matter what, we're still here. I always feel like black people are a little bit like that. You ever have a little persistent little mouse in your kitchen that you just can't get rid of? You see it and it runs by. And then you say, oh, there it is. I'm going to try to kill that little mouse. And you get a sonic boom and then you get traps and then you get some little feeder or something like that. You try everything. But still, despite all of that, yet, that mouse is still sitting there at 3 a.m. when you go to eat that leftover Thai food. It's sitting on your counter, right there. That's us. That's us. Always surviving, sometimes thriving, and without sanctuary. So as I close, friends, I want to extend a reminder to you, a challenge to you, and an invitation to you. And this is specifically to my white brothers and sisters. The reminder, on November 1st, 1850, The Liberator, the Boston anti-slavery newspaper, published by William Lord Garrison, a radical Unitarian white abolitionist, alerted local residents to the presence of two prowling villains. It said that the two slave catchers had come to Boston from Macon, Georgia, with the aim of capturing William and Ellen Craft, a runaway slave couple, under the horrible fugitive slave law. And he wanted to carry them back to the hell of slavery in Georgia. So he was prompted by action by the Craft's plight. And he, along with Boston's black community, gathered to plan their opposition to not only the slave law in court, but they adopted a set of resolutions for the town, for Boston, including a pledge to resist oppression and any attacks on their freedom in the very first issue of his anti-slavery newspaper, The Liberator. William Lord Garrison stated, and I quote, "I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard." And Garrison was heard. For more than 3 decades, from the first issue of his weekly paper in 1831 until after the end of the Civil War in 1865, when the last issue was published, Garrison spoke out eloquently and passionately against slavery and for the rights of American blacks to have sanctuary. Friends, here at this fellowship, be reminded that you can be an ally with a pen and with your voice. You can use your access, use your resources, and be heard like our ancestor was in Boston. Now the invitation. Educate yourself. How many of you have a pretty decent handle on the history of the Reconstruction period in this country? A little bit. Can I have the water? Thank you. A little bit. How many of you have read The Negro Problem from 1960s? Anybody? Okay, I made my point. Educate yourself. Read about the Black Joy Project. Read about Black Girl Magic. Read Audre Lorde. Listen to the speeches by Black humanists on YouTube. Go see if Beale Street could talk. Talk, read, Read slave narratives. They're all online at the Smithsonian Library of Congress. Listen to gospel music. Listen to Kendrick Lamar. Look at Beyonce's Lemonade and learn about our history. Get to know the story of staff that you work with. If you work with black people in any of your fields, get to know them. Listen to Thelonious Monk. Celebrate black survival with me. Celebrate blacks thriving with me. And finally, a challenge. A number of years ago, I was scheduled to preach at the Deerfield Church in Illinois. And my partner, Ashley Horan, right here, is laughing. She remembers this story. And I have a terrible sense of direction. She'll laugh about that, too. And I got lost. Even this is early GPS, you know. And I turned around in an alley or some driveway of some very fancy person, whatever. And all of a sudden, I hear that sound that so many people don't want to hear, particularly on a Sunday morning with your robe in the back seat, and you've got a few minutes to get to church so you can preach on time. And I hear, whoo, 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 whoo. And everybody knows that sound, the sound of the police approaching. And I must have made an illegal turn or done something incorrect. But as I heard that sign, I pull over, and I go into all the things that my parents told me to do when the police pull you over. So I go into my whole routine. I turn off the hip-hop music and turn on the classical station. This is my father actually told me to do that when I was a kid. I'm driving, and I get into sort of this, I go into this subservient kind of shoulders down move feeling, and I just go to my humblest, saddest voice I could possibly start to muster. And because I have one thing in mind, I want to get home. I want to go home, so I'll do anything. I'll sound like a slave if I have to. I'll do anything to get home. So the police comes over, rolls the window down, starts asking me a bunch of dumb questions. We go through this song and dance that white cops and black drivers do every day all over the country. And I said, oh, no, officer, what did I do? I don't know what happened. Okay, I'm so sorry, you know, apologizing. But he couldn't get over the fact that I was going to the church in that area. But I was so close to the church that some of the people in the church, including one of my colleagues, could see me getting pulled over at this point. Because he had me pulled over up a little further, and I was right in front of the church at this point. And I saw my colleague looking at this interchange, and I'm like, dude, get out here. Dude, come on. And he just couldn't get the idea. He says, well, what are you doing? I said, I'm preaching at that church right there. Really? Robe in the back, stole in the back, thrown over the seat. He still couldn't get it. So finally, something must have kicked into my friend. After all, I was there a long time, and service is going to start. Huh?
I kicked him.
You kicked him. Oh, that's right. Okay, the story gets really clear. He was kicked, and he came. And he's a friend. We love him. I love him. And he came, and as soon as he came, the cop just, like, stopped immediately. And everything was well. All was good. But I say that to say that he stood there a long time. And my eyes got really wide, and I got kind of angry. And I had to ask him later, you know, like, what's up with that? And he couldn't really say anything about it. But years later, he did write a sermon that talked about that. And while he didn't have an answer then, I think he did later. And here's a little piece, a summary of what I think he said. I let my colleague down. I looked at her the same way I look at black men getting stopped by the police. I assume they did something wrong. I looked at my colleague the same way. That's a frightful situation to play over and over in my head. Since then, I have made a commitment to show up, lean in, and walk towards. Friends, sanctuary is about a few seconds for some people. It's a few seconds where you show up. Where you show up. And as I say now, I said, come on, man, wipe me up. Wipe me out. You know, help me out. Wipe me out. You know, show up when they're getting ready to do something to me. I saw the most incredible video the other day, and I watch all these videos of black people being beaten and all this stuff, and I probably shouldn't do it. But I watched this one, and this guy is selling water in Las Vegas, and he's down on the ground. The police have their head, their knees into his neck, and there are three of them all over him. And this one middle-aged white woman, you can tell, is just videotaping the whole thing, making stinging commentary to them as they do it. And she says, "Tell me your name. Tell me your number. Who are your people?" And she gets all of that on video, and she says, "I'm going to call them all right now." And so he's yelling out his humanity, his dignity, his people, his community, because she has the moral imagination that this is wrong. She has the generativity to think about his family. So I ask you now to stand on the side of the curb when you see something happen. When ICE is coming after your landscaper, open the door and say, "Come in." Speak and do and bring hope to others through your actions. Pick up the phone, call, engage, and work together that we can provide sanctuary for more than just a few. Blessed be.